Okay, it's gonna be one of those shows. I'm John, this is the Damage Report. What do you think we're gonna talk about? Come on, huh? We're gonna talk about Emmy nominations. Did you see that in female guest stars on a drama, Game of Thrones picked up 4 nominations, including Gwendolyn Christie, who had perhaps her best season of Game of Thrones. I'm joking, of course we're gonna talk about the Trump rally. But in addition to that, and we are gonna be breaking down how horrific, how sickening, and how scary indeed last night's white supremacist rally was, we have other stuff going on as well. We have 3 different guests who are gonna be joining us to break down a number of different important topics. First up, we're gonna be talking about a climate emergency declaration in the House that's being pushed for in the Senate as well. Then we're gonna be joined by the executive director of the Justice Democrats to break down 3 new candidates that they're backing. We're also gonna respond to some of the recent attacks to the already elected Justice Democrats. That should be a really good conversation. And then also, attacks against migrants, we've talked about that a lot. But what does not get a lot of coverage is how, in particular, migrants who are members of the LGBTQ community have been victimized by the Donald Trump administration and his immigration policy. And so a representative from GLAAD is gonna be joining us a little bit later on the show to break down that. And then after the rally last night, the Republicans, either on Fox News, the online commentators, the politicians, have any of them seen the light? I mean, I think you know where this is going, but we're gonna break down some of the responses at the close of the show. If there's time, Meghan McCain somehow makes last night about her. That's her special talent. We've identified one. But with that, we are going to transition to the rally last night because it is horrendous. At last night's Donald Trump rally, I jumped the shark. He bested himself. Like, it was horrendous. You know what it was, but in case you didn't see it, here's what happened.
Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Admittedly, it's a little bit hard to hear what they're saying there, but I've listened to it a few times and I think they're chanting, it's like a call and response, economic anxiety, back and forth. I think that's what it was. No, it was more racism. There's so many things about that are horrendous that we're gonna break down here. One I wanna focus on, which is, I guess it's a small part of it, but I mean, you can't quite see in the little video we have to the side, right on the right hand side of that, there, thank you. Do you see, I mean, obviously, the crowd of Trump supporters, you have a little girl. There's a little girl wearing a MAGA hat and she looks a little bit confused. But as the chant goes on, she starts chanting it. She has no idea what any of that means, but this is how she is being raised, to chant, send her back to a woman of color in the US government. So what's gonna happen to her? I mean, they talk about wanting people to have freedom and not be indoctrinated. What happens to a kid who is brought to a white supremacist rally where people are chanting about their hatred for literally, I think, the second Muslim female member of Congress ever? I mean, it's absolutely horrendous. There's gonna be more bizarre childhood cruelty at this event too. But I mean, is this the worst thing that we've seen at a Trump rally? I don't think it's the worst thing we've seen at a Trump rally. Everybody seems to have forgotten that back in March, Donald Trump literally joked at a Florida rally that about one potential solution to the migrant crisis was to start shooting him at the border. I know that seems crazy because we don't remember anything for more than a day or two in this country, but that actually happened. This is on the same-ish level, I would say. Just insane out and out racism that, of course, because it never breaks through, his defenders will never acknowledge his racism. But I wanna focus on an image. So we've shown you the video. Here's an image from that rally. Let's bring that up. It's a screenshot from MSNBC. And I want you to look at that. You can see Donald Trump in the middle there. And take a look at the crowd. And you know where this is going, but you'll notice something about the crowd. You see a lot of MAGA hats, sure. And you see the back of a lot of white necks. And here's the thing. If you support Donald Trump, there's a good chance that you're a racist, no matter where you are. If you go to a Trump rally, there is no argument that there is any reason you are doing that now, other than that you want to be in a room where you finally feel confident expressing your racism loud and proud, as loud as you want, knowing there will be no consequences. Worst case scenario, somebody slaps you on the back, oh, I heard what you said. But for people who have wanted desperately to be able to shout racial slurs and just express how much they hate people that are not like them. This is Graceland. This is the culmination of everything they've wanted, to be surrounded by people who only believe exactly the things they do, and to be incentivized in the worst sort of mass mob behavior to just express raw hatred towards this woman who supports, you know, like absolving students of their debt. She's repulsive, anti-American. She wants to help out people who have student loan debt. And that's why you go to those crowds. And the thing is, like, how many years now have we been covering these crowds? This is the natural evolution of that he is going to just sit there, say nothing to stop them, and just bask in the obvious outcome of the campaign he's been launching against Ilhan Omar and other members of the squad for the last, I mean, quite a while, but especially the last few days. And what I worry is that the worst case scenario is not just that you have a crowd of people who love expressing these racial hatreds, even though they know they're being filmed. It's that you might have worse than that there. Can we bring up this screenshot from an article a little ways back? You remember Cesar Sayoc, who said that Trump rallies were his newfound drug? He didn't start off a radical right winger, a radical fan of Donald Trump. He started going to these rallies and it was fun. And it was exciting, and he was told who to hate, and it felt good to hate people. And then he was given a list of targets that he decided to send pipe bombs to. And my hope is that that crowd, that shot we showed you, doesn't include any future Cesar Sayocs. And that's the gamble that we have to make as a country, that he's gonna have these rallies. It's going to attract people who go there to be told which people of color in this country to hate. And we just hope, hopefully, they're not violent. That's our hope. Hopefully it's not gonna be the Coast Guard lieutenant who wanted to start a race war by shooting up a bunch of people. It's not Cesar Sayoc who went down the list of all the political opponents that Donald Trump provided to him to send pipe bombs to. Hopefully it's just horrendous, horrendous racism. And that is what I'm hoping for today. And I'm really hoping that Ilhan Omar is protected against the people who want her sent away. A couple days ago it was, remember, he just means like she could go if she wants. For a little bit, and maybe she comes back. You know, it's all about what she wants. Maybe she wants to leave. It took like 72 hours for that to be send her back to the most powerful person in our country and the world. Send her away. You don't send someone away who wants to leave. You force this American citizen who is a servant to the US government to leave our country. That was 72 hours. What about in a week? What about in 6 months? Can you see where this election is going? Donald Trump loves that applause. There's literally nothing he likes more in the world than that feeling. And he's gonna chase that high. And what's gonna happen at the next rally? Now, Ilhan Omar, who obviously we're thinking of at this point, she responded on Twitter, the definition of class, with a quote from Maya Angelou saying, "You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still like air I'll rise." And so she's being both classy and strong in the face of this insane threat to her life. She went on to say, "I am where I belong at the people's house, and you're just gonna have to deal with a shot of her presiding over the US House of Representatives," which for me as a normal, rational person, that image fills me with pride for what America could be, has never been, but could be moving in the right direction. But that same image, can you imagine if Donald Trump had put that on a big screen in front of that crowd? Can you imagine what they would say? There are just different sorts of people in this country. Others have stood up in defense of her. A lot of people, Bernie Sanders had a great tweet saying, "Trump is stoking the most despicable and disturbing currents in our society. And that very hatred and racism fuels him. We must fight together to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of our country." But others, of course, have defended him as well. Here's what I would like. Maybe there will be condemnation. Maybe there will be a House resolution or something. That's all well and good, fine, let's do that. Let's impeach him before he gets Ilhan Omar assassinated. How about that? How about we don't wait until after one of his insane supporters that wants to kill people desperately, might be such a F up that they can't actually make good on it, but desperately wants to kill his political opponents. How about we get him out of office before that actually happens? That would be nice. And this message goes not to those supporters and not to Donald Trump, but to Nancy Pelosi, the person who is principal in stopping any effort towards impeachment from going on. Lives are at risk. He is playing with more than fire, and there are people who are defending him who should know better. Now, I want to turn to other aspects of the rally just briefly. And so let's say some of the other things that were going on last night. So at that Trump rally, Trump was mainly interested, obviously, in Ilhan Omar. Oh, by the way, that was a scripted part of his speech. It was a long, rambling speech, the second longest that he's given as president. The Ilhan Omar part was scripted, but other stuff popped up. And we're not going to show you more of the video because it might literally drive you insane. But I do want to just touch on a few of the hits. So Jordan Yule was one of the first to tweet out. Trump just pointed out a baby someone was holding up and talked about how beautiful the baby is. The parents are apparently QAnon believers because they had put a big Q on the back of the baby so that when they held it up, it would be on TV. Apparently, the parents are YouTubers who are looking like to help themselves in their career out. And as bad as I feel for the little girl in the background of Trump who is chanting, send her home or send her away, that baby, that's gonna be a rough road for that baby. If your parents are such rabid QAnon believers, literally the dumbest conspiracy theory in American history, that they're emblazoning your back with a Q. But there was more, including more racism. Daniel Dale was live tweeting some of the rally so that people wouldn't have to see it. Trump called Ocasio-Cortez, and then says, somebody said, that's not her name, sir. Again, sir, so this conversation didn't happen because he put a sir in, but he says he responded, no, no, I don't have time to go with three different names. We'll call her Cortez, too much time. Takes too much time, the room is quiet. It's not three different names, it's her name. And you're not saying it because you don't have time, you talked for 2 hours. You're saying it to denigrate her and to try to make it more common because people wanna find casual ways with just an air of plausible deniability where they can launch racist attacks against someone who committed the sin of having Cortez in their name. Going on, Trump said that some of the migrants in detention are so happy to be there and that they've said, quote, we've never lived like this before. They have water. They have air conditioning. They have things they've never seen. They've seen water before, I think. I think they've seen air conditioning. That did not happen. That has not been said. That's an insane, insane thing to say as you were holding these people in horrible conditions and some of them are dying. Trump on human trafficking, quote, nobody talks about it. He says it sounded to him, quote, like an ancient crime when he first heard about it as a politician, but now he knows it's a severe problem. He became a politician when he was like 69 years old. He reached 69 and didn't know that human trafficking was an issue. Okay, that's crazy. Trump went on to say he's never had an empty seat at any of his events. He has had empty seats at many events, Daniel Dale acknowledged. I would just ask you, saying you've never had an empty seat at any of your events, is that as crazy or more or less crazy than saying you've never bowled less than a 300? I think it's in the same realm. It's obviously not true, but the cult of personality has reached North Korean levels in that respect. Trump went on to refer to Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas. He expressed regret for starting to call her that too early. Since she has now had time to improve in the polls, he says he will bring it up again if she's the nominee and it'll be very successful. I have no doubt that it'll be successful in getting his followers to chant it and stuff like that. You know, Native Americans are not one of the main groups that they love to express racial hatred against, but they're certainly willing to engage in it if it's fun. So get ready for that later on in the primary. Trump also said people back there in the media, somebody said he's actually kept more promises than he's made. That didn't happen. He said that, and now he's attributing to other people. That happened multiple times. He said that they're saying that I say that we're giving undocumented immigrants free Rolls Royces. That's what the Democrats want to do. He first joked about it at a rally, and then he just started stating it as fact, and now he's attacking the media for saying that he said it. So that's what you get if you go to these rallies. It is just off the walls, rambling. It's the ramblings of a person whose brain is melting out of their ears. And unfortunately, before that happens, they have an incredible amount of power. And so regardless if it's more casual racism, if it's conspiracy theories being laughed at and applauded, it is just insanity and that's our president. That's the world that we're living in. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots of important news to get to after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called The Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of The Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Our climate continues to break down around us, and for the most part, DC's response is meh. But there are some people who take it seriously and are considering declaring a climate emergency declaration. And joining us now to break down what that would mean and what we need to do is Executive Director of the Climate Mobilization, Margaret Klein Solomon. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
Very glad to have you here. And so this climate emergency declaration, what would that actually be? And what's the hope? What would it accomplish?
The Climate Emergency Declaration is the United States government finally telling the truth about the climate emergency, the fact that everything is on the line, this is a risk to all of us, and it needs to be treated with that level of seriousness and intensity. What the resolution calls for is a massive mobilization, a transition of our economy to not only mitigate, but actually reverse global warming. So basically, it's an entirely new paradigm in terms of responding to climate.
Okay, and what about precedents in other countries? Have there been other countries that have gone down this sort of path to try to make clear how important this emergency is and what we need to do to address it?
Yes, so over 800 local governments in 16 countries have declared a climate emergency, including New York City, Paris, Sydney, and Los Angeles. And countries are starting to follow as well. The United Kingdom, Portugal, Canada, and France have all declared a climate emergency.
And so, I saw that Senator Bernie Sanders, Representatives Blumenauer and Ocasio-Cortez were involved in this effort. Do we have any idea of how supported it would be, the chance that it would pass not only the House, but the Senate, and what the path forward might look like?
So there's 55 co-sponsors now, with including seven presidential candidates. So yeah, we do think it can pass the House. Probably it can't pass the Senate right now, but honestly, it depends on how strong of a movement we can build and how quickly we can get the United States to realize how acute this crisis is. Right now we're focused on getting it to pass the House. And I should add, you should go to climateemergency.us to tell your congresspeople to declare a climate emergency.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the work of people who are trying to move the country in the right direction on these issues. Obviously, you're executive director of the Climate Mobilization, obviously very involved in this. Here on the show, we try to get people to acknowledge how serious this problem is and what needs to be done about it. Right now, we're in the middle of a primary, and as you pointed out, many of the candidates have signed on to this. Hopefully, if one of them were to become president, they would act on it. But of course, there's a chance that Donald Trump could win re-election, or one of the candidates who perhaps does not prioritize dealing with the climate breakdown might become president. If this election does not go in the right direction, what should activists who are environmentally focused, what should they do to make sure that we mitigate the damage?
So yeah, obviously Donald Trump getting reelected is a nightmare scenario for a lot of reasons, including the climate. And I think it is a top priority for the movement to do everything that we can to prevent that from happening. And that includes telling the truth about the climate emergency and advocating for a solution that could actually work. By doing so, we can set ourselves up for success. I mean, the climate crisis is accelerating. It's getting worse all the time. It's showing itself. It's tremendously damaging effects all over the country. And so strong climate action is actually popular. So by pushing Democrats and candidates to embrace this new paradigm of climate change is not a problem, it is an emergency that requires World War II scale climate mobilization, mm-hmm. we can actually help them get elected and then obviously initiate that. If it doesn't happen, if Donald Trump gets reelected or the GOP gets reelected, it just means we need to build the movement even stronger. I mean, that is really a terrible situation, but people power can overcome suicidal and corrupt regimes. Mm-hmm. So we're going to need to do it.
Yeah.
But let's prevent it if we can.
Exactly, because of course we know that the timeline is already very much not in our favor for action taking place today, let alone action taking in 2 or 4 or 8 years. You mentioned there the nightmare scenario if he were to be reelected, but of course he's already been president for a couple of years as someone who is integrally involved in this movement. How would you rate his record on the climate and the environment so far?
Absolute failure. However, it is worth noting that the Democratic Party has also been terribly weak on climate as well. And that the Clean Power Plan, Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan, that Donald Trump is dismantling, but the Clean Power Plan was never going to prevent the collapse of civilization mm-hmm. and the living world. Yeah. Only an emergency transition of our economy and society can do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so on this particular issue, perhaps more than others, there's a lot of blame to go around. And hopefully, fingers crossed, this election will help to redo or to undo some of that damage or fix the situation. Margaret Klein-Solomon of the Climate Mobilization, thank you so much for joining us on this issue. And we certainly hope that it does pass.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we're going to be breaking down some of the new candidates who are going to be running in this cycle after this. The quest to improve the House of Representatives and the Senate continues, but long before general election day, one of the most important parts of that quest is making sure that we have the right candidates to eventually run in the general election. And joining us once again to break down some of those new candidates is Executive Director for the Justice Democrats, Alexandra Rojas. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe.
Great to have you back on, and especially now when we've talked about Jessica Cisneros and Jamal Bowman. There are three new Justice Democrats that are going to be running, and I'd love to find out more about them.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we have Cori Bush out of Missouri's 1st District, who we endorsed last cycle as well. Betsy Sweet, who's running out in Maine against Susan Collins. So that's our first Senate candidate. And we also have Marie Newman out in Illinois' 3rd District, which we endorsed last time as well, who's going against Dan Lipinski, who's similar to Henry Cuellar in a lot of ways. I would say they are the most undemocratic Democrats mm-hmm. of the U.S. House of Representatives. And obviously, Susan Collins is our first Republican that we're going after. So we're showing a lot of excitement. And of course, I think, what you alluded to earlier, which is that if we want to elect champions of a Green New Deal, of Medicare for all, and have them all do it without any corporate PAC or corporate lobbyist money, we have to get involved now, not 6 months later.
Exactly.
There are over 70% of the country that doesn't get involved in competitive elections at all. And so it's on us to mobilize our people power.
So I have to ask you a few questions about those races. I'm fairly certain, but correct me if I'm wrong, Dan Lipinski, he is the anti-choice Democrat? Is that correct?
Yes, that's true. And he was one of the only Democrats just recently to vote against LGBTQ, a bill related to LGBTQ people. So again, another Democrat in our party that is sort of Democrat in name only, not necessarily when it comes to their voting record and their alignment with the GOP.
Yeah, and the issue isn't just that he holds these positions that are 100% out of the mainstream of the Democratic Party. It's that I imagine Mary Newman is going to be facing not just Dan Lipinski, but the machine of the Democratic Party, which is going to protect their incumbent. And so, how is she feeling about the battle that she's going to face to differentiate herself from him, be attacked probably for acknowledging his flaws and going up against what will probably be a well-funded primary opponent?
Well, I think what we're focused on is making the case to voters, right? I think at the end of the day, DC elites, people that are out in Washington, DC, are going to run their race. And what we're going to do when we don't have big money and sort of funded by corporations, we're going to invest in people power. And you can already see her not only doing that, we're hosting a national weekend of action with all of our Justice Democrat candidates, you know, a year out, because we know that if we want to be able to go up against entrenched incumbents, we have to get started now. And then also, if you look at her quarter two fundraising numbers, she's right there with Lipinski. So I think we're already seeing that the DCCC blacklist is backfiring on the DCCC, and we're showing that we're competitive in these races, and they're nervous about it.
Okay, and so we're going to be looking to talk to all of these candidates. We've actually talked with Betsy Sweet not too long ago. And I want to talk to you about Cori Bush. So Justice Democrats obviously must have learned quite a bit over this last cycle. And as you pointed out, Cori Bush ran the last time around. What is her approach going into a second fight for this seat in this next cycle?
Well, I think, you know, like you said, we learned a whole lot about, I think, campaigning, not just from the mechanics of how to actually do the campaign, but what it's like being a candidate themselves. And I think Cori, now going through this her second time, has a bit more understanding of the level of, I think, time and work that she has to put in. Not that she didn't do it last time, but again this time, right? When we know that we're going to be outspent, that's why we're getting ready over a year early and hosting events like our Weekend of Action to be able to show that, even though, you know, we might not be able to compete in terms of corporate donations, we are going to be able to compete with people power. So this time around, it's a lot more intentional, I think, in making sure that our field operations are, you know, being as utilized and as effectively used as possible.
And hopefully also, you know, she's more of a known quantity in the region, and that might work to her advantage this time around.
With Knock Down the House, I think it's also nationally too, and I believe she and some of the other folks from Knock Down the House also recently became national Bernie Sanders surrogates. So I think that's also going to help as well.
Exactly. So I have to ask, you know, we've been breaking down some of the new Justice Democrats. There are a number that have already been elected, and they have very much been in the headlines lately, not necessarily for the reasons I would like. They've been targeted by the Democratic Party, by Nancy Pelosi, and now, including last night, just viciously and in a racist fashion from the President of the United States. You know, as someone who has worked with these women, what is your response to the recent attacks?
I think that if Donald Trump wants to make the squad the face of the Democratic Party, then we need to use this opportunity to talk about our vision for America, because what they're counting on and what they're doing, right, is weaponizing race. It's not just Donald Trump, right? It's Fox News. It's the entire Republican Party and the billionaire class that they represent that are weaponizing racism in order to divide working people in this country. They're using these four congresswomen to say, hey, be afraid, not just of undocumented immigrants now, but of all black and brown people. So I think that Democratic leadership needs to take this moment seriously. If we want to remember the events that led up to this very moment, to where it was susceptible for the president to come and do this, you know, a lot of that happened under Democratic leadership's watch. And so we need to be extremely careful moving forward on, I think, articulating our vision for the America that we want to see, because we know that it's way more popular. People are excited about Medicare for All. They're excited about universal education, not just, you know, through high school, but all the way through college. People are excited about a living wage, at least at $15 an hour, and so much more. And if we want to win in 2020, we need to mobilize our base. So I think that although, you know, these attacks are causing a lot of, you know, press coverage around the congresswoman, I think it's our opportunity to talk about our progressive vision for America, because we know that Americans are hungry for change right now.
And I suspect your answer might be similar, but I also have to point out that in the initial, right after his tweet storm on Sunday attacking the squad, you also had Axios releasing the poll conducted by an anonymous group, apparently of top Democrats, in an incredibly deceptive fashion, attempting to attack both Ilhan Omar and Ocasio-Cortez, implying that they're unpopular in what could well be either an entirely fabricated poll or the worst designed poll in the history of American politics. And that's not Trump. That's coming from the establishment of the Democratic Party. And so how did you respond to that?
Well, I mean, they basically only polled white non-college educated voters and basically ignored the reality that women of color also carried swing states in the 2018 election. So I think it's not only extremely tone deaf, it's extremely offensive to the people within those districts when you're only talking to white people. And I think what we've shown is that if the reality is that we're trying to cater to Trump supporters in order to win them back into the Democratic Party, we just saw on full display last night of some of those folks. So I think we need to paint a vision that is not just trying to win back Trump supporters. We need to win back everybody on the table, and that's young people, that's people of color, that's working class people of all backgrounds, that's union households. And the way that we do that isn't by just catering to people that we know are gonna vote, it's by going after the millions and millions of people that are sitting at home right now, that are cynical, that don't believe that their government is working for them. And Democrats have an opportunity to speak to them. And we don't need to do it by compromising our values on separating families or putting kids in cages. We can do it by talking about our vision for economic, racial, environmental, and social justice.
And hopefully people will help you and the Justice Democrats to do that by, if they're interested in finding out more about Mary Newman, Betsy Sweet, or Cori Bush, of course, Justice Democrats' website is there. Alexandra, as always, we appreciate you joining us on the show.
Thanks so much.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. Joining us now to break down an angle that doesn't get talked about nearly enough in the immigration issues that are going on right now is Chief Programs Officer at GLAAD, Zeke Stokes. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you. We're glad to have you on. So we've been talking a lot about what's been going on at the border, the horrendous conditions that migrants are being held in. But one aspect of the story that doesn't often get focused on is the sort of unique problems and issues surrounding how the immigration and asylum policies affect members of the LGBTQ community in particular. And I would love to learn more about that.
Sure. You know, there are about 900,000 LGBTQ immigrants in the United States, and about 260,000 or so of them are undocumented. And so, you know, obviously the first important thing to remember here is that asylum seeking is a legal form of immigration. So these are not people who are arriving in this country illegally. And many times they're traveling and they're traveling to the US and fleeing very horrific homophobic, transphobic conditions in their own countries in Central and South America in particular. And so, you know, when we look at the situation of children in cages and people in cages behind chain link fences at the border, you know, the thing that we've been so outraged about, it does impact LGBTQ people in some cases a little bit differently. That's because, you know, if you don't have access to your hormone therapy and other medical interventions for transition, then transgender people are obviously are affected in a different kind of way. Also, many people who may be HIV positive, who aren't getting their medications, those are critical days and critical hours to have a break in medication. And so if they're not providing that kind of health care, and of course we know they're not, then LGBTQ people are being affected in ways that are very unique to them, but also are fleeing these countries in ways that are very unique to our community.
So that's a long list of concerns that are very real. And we know that, I mean, they're fleeing from countries that are, they're incredibly at risk there. They're coming to a country that is moving in the exact wrong direction on many of these issues we know. Do we have accounts of migrants that are being mistreated in this particular way? I mean, I know that people are being denied access to, you know, places to sleep and soap and things like that. So I'm assuming that the treatment has been quite horrendous.
Absolutely. We do know. We do hear from them at GLAAD. We do have a network of resources where we can point people, the ACLU, the Immigration Law Project, other places that we point people to receive assistance. But we do know that at least two trans women have died while in custody because they weren't receiving proper health care, or they were in conditions that just were untenable for them. And that's just what we know about. We know of one woman who was sent back to the country from which she came and then died there very, very quickly because of the conditions in that country. She was a victim of violence back in her home country. So we do know that it's happening, and you are right. These immigrants are arriving at a country that is moving backwards on LGBTQ rights, not forward. We've seen this administration issue more than 100 attacks in both policy and rhetoric on the LGBTQ community since the president took office. And we track those through our Trump Accountability Project here at GLAAD. Your viewers can go on glaad.org/Trump to see all of those attacks. And it's everything from removing us from the White House website on the day of his inauguration, all the way through removing us from the census, banning transgender service members from the military, promoting religious, so-called religious liberty that is really nothing more than a license to discriminate. We've seen it, we see it day in and day out, a network of judges appointed across the country who are insistent and intent on turning the clock back on the progress that we've made over the past 50 years. So it's a bad time to be LGBTQ in this country. But even so, these folks are arriving at a place that's better than the place that they're coming from, where they're fleeing violence, they're fleeing persecution, they're fleeing terrible conditions. And we should be welcoming them as we welcome all immigrants fleeing and arriving here for asylum with open arms and open hearts.
And finally, we have the ICE raids that have been rumored to be starting. Depending on who you talk to, they either started last weekend or ICE officials are saying that they didn't. But assuming that they do proceed, do you have a particular advice considering the concerns that we've been talking about?
Sure. You know, this is a terror tactic by the president, and whether they're happening at the same level that was reported in the media or not, we tend to believe that they're not. The fact is that these kinds of this kind of rhetoric is sending immigrants, migrants, their families further into the shadows, further into the closet. And we see folks who are scared to go to work. They're scared to go to church. And so they lose if they stay in their home. They lose if they go to work because they're afraid that they may face some action there. So it's likely that they're losing their jobs because they're now afraid to go to work. So these are really, really terrible conditions. And if people are feeling threatened in their home, the first thing they should know is unless an ICE agent has a warrant, they can't enter your house without a warrant for arrest. A warrant for deportation or removal is not enough. Even if someone opens their door and asks for ID from the immigration agents, the ICE agents, that opening of the door does not allow them to come into your home. Go to the ACLU website at aclu.org, where there's an amazing list of resources. Go to glaad.org, where we have an amazing list of resources that can really help people stand up for themselves, know their rights, and fight back.
Very important information, very timely as well. And so Zeke Stokes, we want to thank you for joining us and breaking down these issues for us.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We have just a little bit more time. We're going to do a roundup of some of the Republican politicians and members of the right-wing media and how they have responded to the insane racist rally we saw last night.
You know how you make America great again? Tell Donald Trump to go to hell.
Bringing out the worst in us.
Disparaged women.
Opportunistic.
Religious bigotry.
Race baiting.
Xenophobia.
He's a jackass.
That was Senator Lindsey Graham going on every media program to denounce Donald Trump after last night's racist rally. Nah, I'm just playing. That's from back before he was the candidate, let alone president. Now he's fallen very much in line. But back when he was freed up from loyalty to the dear leader, he was very critical of Donald Trump for exactly the sort of thing that was on display at last night's rally, where his supporters were gleefully chanting that Ilhan Omar should be sent back to a place that she's no longer a citizen of. So that's what happened with Lindsey Graham. Now, let's flash forward to this morning where he was asked about that. Bear in mind the things he said in the past. Here's what he said when asked about whether or not that was racist.
No, I don't think it's racist to say, was it racist to say love it or leave it? I don't think a Somali refugee embracing Trump would not have been asked to go back. If you're a racist, you want everybody from Somalia to go back because they're black or they're Muslim. That's not what this is about to me.
Was it racist to say if you like it, you should have put a ring on it? I'm a very serious politician. That was nonsense. Lindsey Graham he's a joke in a city filled with jokes. He stands out as the funniest one, perhaps. The idea that like the love it or leave it thing, first of all, you flash back, you can go back decades. Those sorts of attacks have always been racist. Everybody knows that. But especially they've stripped away the consent. Now it's send her back. To imply that that is not racist, that uniformly white crowd that was chanting that was not motivated by racial animus is ridiculous. And it's beneath the low, low bar of US politics to not be willing to admit that. The idea that they would be okay with her if she supported Donald Trump, that's a particularly weird form of racism. That she can exist as a congresswoman in the US, in the US Congress, if she supports the president, otherwise she should be deported to her home country. That's not like a clever out. That's just more racism on top of the racism of a particular sort that says a lot about the Republican Party and their views on black people, brown people, whether they're inside or outside of the party. It's all racist. It just comes in different flavors, whether or not those people agree with you politically. But that was just awful. He's just one politician though, others have been terrible too. Representative Mark Walter said this. This is what passes, by the way, for a condemnation. You have the people who deny that it was racist at all, even at this point. And then you have things like this. Though it was brief, I struggled with the send her back chant tonight referencing Representative Omar. Her history, words, and actions reveal her great disdain for both America and Israel. That should be our focus and not phrasing that's painful to our friends in the minority communities. It is hard to come up with a condemnation that is more condemning of the person than the thing that we're debating right now, and that might be it. Though it was brief, they chanted send her back for 10 to 20 seconds, 25 seconds maybe, I'm not sure. It wasn't brief, and he is just as racist in her attacks, in his attacks against her. Julie Davis tweeted out that the NRCC chair Tom Emmer says of send her back chant, there's no place for that kind of talk, I don't agree with it. And then goes on to say, there's not a racist bone in Trump's body. What he was trying to say, he said wrong. Yeah, he's been carrying on for this full week, refining and doubling and tripling and octupling down on his message. He's not racist, he just can't quite say it wrong. Now I agree, he doesn't know how to speak and he doesn't understand the English language, but that's not the issue here. It's very much founded in racial animus. More responses from politicians will of course roll in as the day goes on. But this is what you can pretty much expect. People who just deny that it's an issue or say, I wouldn't have said it that way. This isn't the way we should focus on it. And here's 10 things that I'm gonna say to slander Representative Omar as well. Once again, setting the stage for more comments like this. I wanna give you a taste of how this is gonna work on the pundit side. So you have Ben Shapiro, the guy who's never seen racism in his life, doesn't believe it exists, says vile. Omar is awful. She's a radical anti-Semite with terrible views. She's also an American citizen and chanting for a deportation based on her exercise of the First Amendment is disgusting. This is the sort of pathetic, cowardly thing that is better than what most of them will say, but is awful in its own way. Vile. He said one word to condemn it and then turned to attacking Ilhan Omar once again. She's a radical anti-Semite, of course, not true with terrible views. Like his issue with it is that she gets to exercise her rights. She's terrible, something bad should happen, but she shouldn't be deported. That's what he believes. And again, by the way, no acknowledgement that it's racist. It's vile, but I won't say why. I won't say how, I won't say what is particularly vile about it, how it is a continuation of a strain of thought in American politics that's been around since before we were actually a country. But understand who he actually is, because while he says that that is awful, take a look at what happened on his show yesterday with a guest.
She was so angry, she almost exploded, but the TSA took the belt off her. She is as bad. She is as bad.
We're going to give a Media Matters break.
Media Matters. We love you, Media Matters.
Yeah, hey, thank you.
Come and get me.
Here's the photo for the article.
Okay, for Media Matters, she's not actually a suicide bomber, nor is she an Islamic terrorist. She just believes bad things. That's true.
I think it's vile. Why would you ever say anything like that? I also think it's kind of funny when somebody jokes that a woman who came here as a refugee, worked her entire life, became a congresswoman, is the perfect distillation of the American dream. Maybe she's a terrorist. It's a good thing the TSA took off her explosive belt. That's what I think. And then when they realize that, oh wait, there's a camera rolling, they joke about the fact that it's satire. Once again, proving that the issue with comedy on the left and the right isn't that the right is bad at it necessarily. It's that they have no idea what comedy is or what the purpose of it is. There's some very weird ideas about what's funny. And joking that a congresswoman is maybe a terrorist is not a light jab. It's just more racism. Weird that he can't see it when it's Trump or when it's a guest sitting in front of him. He can't condemn it any more than Trump would condemn that chant. There was a lot more. We'll get to it at some point, but unfortunately, we are running out of time for the show. Donald Trump, by the way, also he's been asked questions about this since last night. Take a look at that. You can expect it later on the main show of the Young Turks. We've got one more show. We're gonna have Brett Ehrlich on tomorrow, as well as a couple of awesome guests. So certainly look forward to that, and I'm sure more fallout from the insane racism that we saw on display at last night's rally. Thank you, as always, for watching. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.